Hour two of your Thursday edition of Justice and Drew is underway. Welcome back to the show. 651-989-5855 is the phone number, or please use the hashtag TCNT on Twitter.
I had a chance to, and it was my first time, I'll be honest, my first time I had a chance to actually travel through Wisconsin last weekend. It was very lovely. I want to go back and spend more time there and all the things that were enticing me to pull off the side of the road.
You should go to Wisconsin Dells sometime.
On my travels down to Chicago. Family. I told Melinda that. I actually tracked the hours to a couple of the key sort of touristy locations and made a list of places that I want to go to now.
Joining us now, been far too long since we've had him on the show, our adopted senator from Wisconsin, Ron Johnson. Good morning, sir.
Morning, guys. I'm glad you enjoyed your trip to God's country.
Yeah, well, I'm not becoming like a, you know, I'm still going to maintain my allegiance to the Vikings. Let's just not get carried away.
Overnight Packer fan, huh?
But I did enjoy my travel through, and I look forward to returning. Good morning, sir. Thanks so much for joining us this morning. Look, let's get right into it. Introducing legislation to reclaim congressional authority on trade. And Drew, I think you raised probably the relevant question here.
Yeah, I got a press release yesterday. Johnson and a bipartisan coalition introduced legislation to reclaim congressional authority on trade. And my immediate gut reaction is, what do you mean reclaim? When was it? How was it ever lost in the first place? I mean, that is what Congress's role is when it comes to trade, correct?
Sure. Well, in a number of different piece of legislation, Congress has pretty well given its authority on trade and particularly setting tariffs to the executive, to the chief executive. Yeah. And truthfully, guys, we really can only have one negotiator. You can't have 535 members of Congress negotiating, but those negotiations should be occurring with full consultation with Congress and then based on, you know, final approval as well. You know, one thing I think Donald Trump is absolutely correct in is when he talks about reciprocal treatment in trade, he's spot on. We should be demanding it. If we're charging 2.5% tariff on automobiles, for example, the countries should be charging us 2.5%, not 25%. So we should be demanding reciprocal treatment when it comes to tariff levels, as well as the non-tariff barriers that are often erected over time. So, now, I was in the White House yesterday for about a two-hour meeting. I think the president is also spot on, saying that these multilateral agreements are far more complex. And I think he's more and more looking toward just bilateral agreements, which is probably going to be a lot easier to negotiate. So, no way, shape, or form am I trying to undermine the president's negotiating leverage here. But I am highly concerned about, you know, we've been saber-rattling. We've exchanged the first shots in the beginning of a trade war that could spin out of control, and I certainly expressed those concerns as well when I was in the White House.
Yeah, I mean, this is in response to the tariff conversations that have been happening around with the president, but the way this would work if this were to go through would be, like you said, you know, you have one negotiator, you have the president, he goes out, he negotiates those deals, but those deals are not finalized without congressional approval, correct?
Right. And by the way, on a host of issues, Congress has outsourced its constitutional authority to the executive, which is why the presidency has become such a powerful institution. And again, I don't think that's particularly good. It makes no difference whether it's Republican or Democrat in the presidency. Congress needs to jealously guard its constitutional authority. That's what is required for those delicate checks and balances that really were the genius of our founding fathers.
That's the phrase, exact phrase I was going to use. If you're going to have checks and balances, then Congress cannot continue to cede authority to the executive branch. They have to take back that approval mechanism. Obviously, the executive branch does have a wide range, does have a wide berth, a lot of leeway in the things that they can decide. But ultimately, Congress needs to be the one to provide that check and provide the approval or disapproval of a lot of those actions.
You know, classic example is the Iranian agreement. Had President Obama treated that as what it really was a treaty, and then understood that he's going to have to gain ratification through the Senate with a two-thirds vote, it would have been a far better deal. We'd probably still be in place, and it might actually be working. But because he chose to treat that as just an executive agreement, it really wasn't worth the paper it was written on, which is one of the reasons President Trump was so easy to just walk away from it. And I think the proof is already in. That's probably a good thing that he did so.
And you can look at, to use another example, the conversation around DACA, around the Dreamers. You know, had that actually been done the right way with the engagement and with involvement and approval of Congress, we wouldn't be having these perpetual deadlines that, you know, keep getting met and these extensions of the programs. You do things the right way. You do it legislatively. You do it with congressional input, oversight, and approval. And everything is much more... There's much more static, you know. It's easier to plan ahead and understand what's coming down the pike.
Yeah, it's definitely more stable. It doesn't ping pong from, you know, one administration to the next. To the policy is this way for 4 years, then it changes completely 180 degrees the next 4 years. It's not the kind of certainty that an economy certainly is looking for if it wants to grow.
Talking with Senator Ron Johnson. So twofold on this next question. So apart from this introduction of the legislation, but then also relate to the introduction of the legislation, the president just tweeted, and I'll give you the relevant part of the tweet to our conversation. He talks about getting ready to go to the G7 in Canada to fight for our country on trade. And in parentheses, we have the worst trade deals ever made. Then he talks about going off to Singapore to meet with North Korea and the nuclear problem. But in regards to G7, Canada, the fighting for trade being the worst deal ever made. So separate from this, your thoughts on the president's comments about our trade deals with Canada? And then subsequently, does it relate to the legislation that you're introducing?
Well, speaking for Wisconsin, we actually have a trade surplus with both Canada and Mexico. It's not perfect. I've been recently told that Mexico is literally our largest market for cheese out of Wisconsin. So, you know, bilateral trade agreements are extremely important. Now, do they need to be updated? You know, no doubt about it. But, you know, literally since NAFTA was signed into law in the 90s, exports from America to Canada and Mexico have increased by $221 billion. The trade deficit has gone up slightly, close to about $50 billion, but that's still not a bad ratio. And I don't share the president's viewpoint that the primary metric needs to be trade deficits. I'm really looking at overall volume of trade. You know, not that exports are all good and imports are all bad. I mean, there's plenty of good we get from imports, good products at reasonable prices. It creates jobs in distribution and retailing. So you really do need to look at this in a more balanced approach.
When you talk about, you know, Congress sort of reclaiming its authority and Congress taking back a lot of its powers from the executive branch, how much appetite do you sense that there is, I mean, specifically in the Senate, but in Congress as a whole, if you could comment on that, to actually do that? Because it's seemed like for a number of years, especially during the Obama administration, that Congress was sort of all too happy to let a lot of these things get pawned off onto the executive branch because it sort of abdicated them of responsibility and consequences. Is there a solid appetite for having Congress play the role that it is supposed to play in your estimation?
Well, unfortunately, probably not. You know, I had the amendment during the Iranian Agreement Act that would have deemed it a treaty that should have passed 100-0. I don't think I even got 40 votes on that. But, you know, it's really quite partisan. You know, when Republicans in the White House, Democrats want to reclaim the authority. When Democrats in the White House, Republicans want to reclaim the authority. So it certainly has a partisan nature to it. But, you know, you take a look at a lot of these laws that have been written. They're really frameworks for the regulators. And both Dodd-Frank and Obamacare were, you know, a few hundred thousand words as written in law. Now they're 15 and 20 million words between the two of them. You know, it's absurd. And, of course, all those added words, the millions of words added to these frameworks are written by unelected bureaucrats. We've given all that authority to the agencies. I know the Supreme Court, the Chevron decision, gave an awful lot of power to the agencies as well. So the pendulum has swung way too far in favor of the chief executive, and I would say even the courts. And I think Congress really needs to start reclaiming that that power back.
Before we let you go this morning, again, talking with Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson, I'm sure that, you know, you talked about at the start of our conversation that you love things in your home state. That's fine. But we want to give you the opportunity to let our audience know how jealous you are watching our politics over here and what took place this week after the conventions. I'm sure that you really wish that you were in the middle of all of our, you know, really exciting, you know, midterm election moves.
Well, you know, politics is always pretty interesting, but there's always hope, guys. I mean, we were a pretty blue state, 7, 8, 9, 10 years ago, and there's always hope. So, keep working.
Well, I think a lot of us are already doing a lot of praying, especially when it comes to particular seats.
I'd be happy just being purple at this point.
Seriously.
Senator Ron Johnson, thank you so much. Always appreciate your time.
Take care.
We'll talk to you again soon.
Yeah, it is really how things are going to shake out. Is it gonna be a big seismic shift? You know, I mean, certainly is the groundwork is laid out for that to happen. But I don't think, much like the past election, you know, I don't think anybody can say with any kind of confidence whatsoever that they can predict how the rest of this year is going to play out.
No, it's an entirely different ballgame right now, and Trump shook things up. I mean, you know, he performed extremely well here in Minnesota, much better than everybody expected. Can that momentum be sustained? You know, a lot of that has to do with the way the Republicans get out there and message and the way that they get out there and campaign. But a lot of it also has to do with the fact that there is a lot of disarray and divisions, deep chasms.
Right.
Within the DFL right now.
Well, and then you couple that with the bubble effect that we talk about so often, and that's on both sides. That's Republican and DFL. But that bubble effect that people have of being around individuals who, you know, aren't going and really getting a good grasp on the opposition, or, you know, what the climate is of the voters, and that plays a part in it as well. Out of Fox 9, we've got a number of different stories that we're going to work through this hour, sort of the continued coverage after. I mean, even NPR News was like, what's next for Democrats after dumpster fire day? I mean, it's owning it.
NPR used the dumpster fire.
Right?
Yes.
Fox 9 piece.
Everybody use the dumpster fire hashtag.
Excitement or dysfunction? DFL GOP leaders reflect on Kennedy filing frenzy.
Oh,
Minnesota GOP. Minnesota GOP.
Let's take a moment to reflect, everybody.
Minnesota GOP Chairwoman Jennifer Carnahan said on the Democratic side of Minnesota, it's in complete disarray, discord, and dysfunction. The Minnesota Democratic Party Communications Director, Kayla Castaneda, said, I would describe it as exciting. It was definitely a day where we had a lot coming at us, unexpected movements. Yeah, you know what?
Meaning, we don't know what the hell's going on right now.
You know what? I will say this for the communications director comment. I think unexpected movement. That's really fitting. Generally speaking, unexpected movements are not a good thing. No.
No.
And that's not for me personally. I don't look forward to those moments.
No.
Castaneda says the excitement is the DFL's biggest strength. Despite multiple rounds of voting, surprise endorsements at the DFL convention this past weekend, plus the flurry of last-minute filings for governor, Congress, and attorney general just before Tuesday's deadline, she believes the party is not divided in how or who will become the August primary and November election. Yeah, okay. You keep telling yourself that.
How do you reach that conclusion?
Delusion.
Not divide. So everybody's all on the same page. That's why you've got, what, 5 attorney general candidates?
Yeah, of course.
Because everybody's on the same page.
Their strategy is to be positive, talk about what Democrats are for and what we are doing for Minnesotans, how we are going to improve their lives, and making sure we are saying to Minnesotans that in every corner of the state.
Well, okay. Let's talk about how you've improved our lives under Governor Mark Dayton.
Right.
If I need license tabs, you certainly haven't improved my life.
Nope. Nope.
Nope.
Nope. That certainly has not happened.
Nope. If I'm relying on the state exchange for health coverage, you have not improved my life.
Well, and when we get into more of Keith Ellison and this piece from MinnPost talking about the reason, you know, why they believe, and I think Drew, we both agree why he's running for that position. That's not what he's talking about either.
No.
He's talking about he wants to be opposition. He wants to obstruct. He wants to push back again. You know, he'll say to the media, I want to fight for all Minnesotans. No, you don't. No. You want a platform to push your agenda.
Keith Ellison is not running for attorney general to improve any Minnesotan's life. He's running for attorney general to obstruct the president's agenda in the courts as much as possible. That's the only reason he's running.
The Fox 9 article goes on to say, on the Republican side, division with the party exists as well, in large part because of former Governor Tim Pawlenty, who is running for the seat once more. Carnahan said, we are going to be launching the biggest ground game this state has ever seen in over a decade. That means we'll have hundreds of people canvassing the state, knocking on people's doors, making those phone calls, knocking on doors again, walking in parades, making the direct one-on-one contact with voters to be able to share with them in an authentic way. Which party has a winning strategy will be up to voters. This is honestly, Carnahan says, the most important election cycle in Minnesota since perhaps the 1970s. Castaneda said, this is an exciting year. Look, the GOP has a bunch to talk about now. And I think that part of it, I absolutely agree. I think to me, the excitement should really be and is on the GOP side of things. There's no doubt about that because there is ample opportunity now. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to say it's completely wide open, but the chance to go and really distance yourself and cast, you know, your different versions of a better Minnesota, especially in the wake of what Governor Mark Dayton did at the end of the legislative session, you've got tons of examples to get to go out there and to argue why voting for our candidates, these candidates, are the better individuals.
No, you're right. It's not a lock by any stretch of the imagination. In fact, I would say that by and large, statewide Republicans are still underdogs, but the opportunity is there, like it hasn't been for a very long time. For Republicans in statewide races.
Yeah. It's exciting. It's going to be fun. I'm glad we get to talk about it.
I know. It's going to be great.
Coming up, we will get to that MinnPost article. Why is Keith Ellison leaving a safe seat in Congress to make a risky bid for Minnesota Attorney General? And a little bit later on in the hour, guys, I have something we need to get to. It's we have a new Death Watch 2018.
No.
Yeah, it's very sad. Death Watch 2018.
No, God, please, no. No.
Don't be too concerned. It involves foliage.
Justice.
Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130 and 103.5 FM. Welcome back. Your Thursday edition of Justice and Drew. 651-989-5855 is the phone number.
Got a question for both of you before we dive headlong back into the politics here, right? Because things may get heavy, right? But this is something that everybody can relate to. Sam, I want your thoughts as well. Need to answer a question. Okay. Drew, how often do you guys change your sheets?
I don't.
Okay, you don't.
My wife handles that.
Oh, okay. Well, how often does your wife change your sheets?
I have no idea.
Okay. Is there ever...
She just doesn't.
Sam, before you answer... Well, actually, though, I'll get back to you, Drew. Sam, how about you? How often are you changing and cleaning your sheets?
It's been a while.
Right now, what's
like
a while?
Like twice a month now, I guess. Okay. I used to be really like vigilant about it, but not so much anymore.
Drew, is there a moment? Like, is there any like period of time where you go... Sheets haven't been changed in a while. I just get a little gamey. I just kind of need to get done. All right. Okay.
No, I think the magic sheet elves just show up and they do it in a timely fashion.
Must be nice.
That's been my assumption all along.
I honestly don't know. Like my honest answer is whenever Melinda says it's time to change the sheets, right. You know, because we sleep in separate beds because of the sleep schedule, you know, and so she's usually the one to go. You really need to change those. So you're like, if she doesn't go into the room for a long time, I mean, it could be a year. I don't know. I've heard until those are changed. Because it's no simple task with my bed because we've got, like, fitted sheets, and then the dog will get angry sometimes. She's gotten angry at me in the past and has decided to go and take her anger out on my bed. She's very specific about that. So we've had to put, like, things down to make sure that the bed stays safe because of that. So it's a very, like, difficult day. It's like, takes like a day to take my sheets off, to wash them and put them back on. Okay.
That's probably an exaggeration.
When you take,
it's a days long project.
You say that, but it really isn't. When you take removing
you're not hand washing your sheets in the river on a washboard.
When you take removing it. washing them. You're talking. Yeah. You're talking.
Oh my gosh! Put them in the washer. Pop in a movie. Pause it once it's
No. Hold on. Fitted sheet. Right. You have the sheet, the bed protecting sheet.
Okay.
Then you have like the sheet itself, and then you have the comforter. So you're looking at two, maybe three separate loads of laundry.
You don't just wash them all together?
Well, no, because I don't have like an industrial sized washing machine at home to do that.
Apparently, I do. Right. I just shove it all in.
And then usually the comforter takes two rounds of drying because it doesn't always get dry on the first round. So by the time you get through all of that, it does take about a day. The whole reason I bring it up is because Kara Levin tackled this tough question. How often should you wash your sheets? Once a week? Once a month? Does it make a difference? They went to apparently an individual who's an expert, a laundry evangelist. Patrick Richardson.
Is that for real?
That's what they say. They went to the laundry evangelist. Yes, laundry evangelist to get to the bottom of
it.
Patrick Richardson said you probably don't have to wash them as often as you wear your pajamas and socks. Versus if you wear nothing. Okay. He says.
As long as you're clothed.
Right.
Then it's fine to let it go a little bit longer.
Yeah, because I've heard that you actually sweat in the middle of the night more than you know.
I sweat so much when I'm sleeping. Like, I don't know if that's too much information. I don't know if that's like TMI. But I'm like a space heater when I sleep.
I've heard that's the case.
The look that Drew just gave me.
Do you keep Gatorade by your bed?
No.
Because we got to stay hydrated.
What should I? I need a restock of an electrolyte. Yeah.
Like you're running a marathon.
Yeah. I mean, it's not that bad.
Shedding about 18 pounds of water weight tonight.
Richardson said the given answer is once a week. No, there's no way. There's no way. No way.
Yeah.
Seems like a lot. Another individual, this would be Dr. John Fowler, microbiology professor at Concordia College in Moorhead, says that in talking about the sheets getting dirty, there are tens of thousands of your own cells that are falling off your body. It's kind of the way we're designed, dead skin, right? Yeah,
but it's mine.
Right, exactly.
<It's mine>.
Yeah.
I don't worry about it.
That
if it was somebody else's, that'd be kind of gross.
The it's mine thing applies to a lot of stuff. It really does.
Sure.
Right? You know, we won't get into it now because it's early, but that does apply to a lot of stuff. They go on to say, can it make us sick in terms of health benefits? I don't think washing once a week versus once a month is really going to make all that much of a difference. But if we're going with our first expert in washing our sheets once a week, well, who has time to do that? Exactly. Yeah. So they do have three tips. Right, use all-purpose bleach, breaks down anything organic, take your sheets out of the dryer right away. The longer they sit in the dryer, the less comfortable they're going to become, right? And you don't have to wash your comforter as often, maybe once every other month or two or three times.
That's probably assuming that you have like a top sheet.
So there you go. When I saw the story this morning, I should probably wash my...
It's probably time.
Probably wash my... Yeah.
It's been a couple of years.
Yeah. I think, at least...
This is gross.
I mean, at least the election, you know? I'm thinking maybe it's about time.
Once every leap year. I think that's a good gauge. Just doing washing sheets on leap day.
It is funny, though, because there are a few things better than that. Like, there are a few things better. It's the equivalent of when I wash my car and I think my car drives better. Right?
Yeah.
When you wash your sheets and you put new sheets on, like you get this, oh, this feels so great. But really, it feels exactly the same as it did before you washed them.
It's mental, for sure.
Yeah, it is. It is. It's very, very psychosomatic. But I'm big on the psychosomatic.
It works.
I'm a big fan of psychosomatic.
You like tricking yourself.
I psychosomatic.
Into believing things.
Many times an hour.
Doing it right now.
I'm actually convincing myself that this whole bit was good.
This was totally worth doing.
This whole time I've been telling myself that
we've provided valuable information to our listeners.
People are enjoying this, is what I've heard in the back of my head during this entire, like, I could hear people that are answering the question on their own while they listened and thinking to themselves, boy, this content that Justice and Drew are providing is incredibly relevant to my life.
So good.
still doing it.
Sam doesn't help, by the way. I mean, she's not really she's not reaffirming any of this with the side eye that she's giving you this whole time.
Just don't say it's fine and we're good.
That segment was fine.
Okay.
That's just about as that's just about as bad. Yeah. All right. Let's go here, shall we?
Okay. I won't say fine.
Oh, see?
Oh, man.
Yeah, I know. That's the worst.
every guy listening just now is just like his heart just skipped a
beat. Yeah, we had a lengthy conversation off air about how woman saying in response to something, it's fine, is like the worst. It's daggers.
Or likewise, it's okay.
It's like the male equivalent of Samantha Bee saying that other word. Oh, no. It's like almost that bad. Almost. Not quite. All right, what's next for Democrats after dumpster fire day? One DFL analyst out of the story of NPR, Darren Broughton, said this. It is truly remarkable that we are seeing divisions of the DFL come out during a year where we should be united against what's going on in Washington and getting ourselves organized. Going on to say, the DFL Hunger Games are well underway.
Wow.
We need to really.
That's a pretty harsh analogy.
That is really harsh.
We got to utilize that. We need.
Want to utilize that? That's gonna get messy.
We need that bong sound. You know, when somebody's.
Oh, we can play it for Mike Hatch.
Yeah. We can play that
Mike Hatch is up in the sky this morning.
Oh, see, that's really.
Oh,
all
we're
right.
doing that. All we're right. doing that.
See, okay.
Especially tomorrow, if people start withdrawing today.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah, that is right.
Matt Pelican say, I volunteer as tribute.
That doesn't make Keith Ellison Jennifer Lawrence, right?
I sure hope.
Okay, we need to work on this before we go too far down this road.
All right, we need to figure out who's who.
Because Katniss, he is not.
651-989-5855. We will dig into this NPR piece. What's next for the DFL after a dumpster fire day? Plus your calls coming up on Twin Cities News Talk.
Twin Cities News Talk. AM 1130 and 103.5 FM. Justice and Drew, starring Sam.
That's right.
651-989-5855. Use the hashtag TCNT.
We know our role.
It's fine. What's next for Democrats after Dumpster Fire Day? At the heart of the divisions is what kind of party the DFL will be going forward. Man, again, just take all of this commentary and replace, like, you replace it with GOP and you go, okay, that makes sense. Because that's what you always hear. Mm-hmm. You don't ever hear it going the other way. Do Democrats try to be more moderate, centrist party, win back rural and independent voters they lost in the last election cycle? Or do they embrace new voters and activists into the party and double down on a progressive platform to excite them?
That is a core question. What's sort of being lost in that question is the fact that those activists and those new voters, they will absolutely refuse any attempts to win back the rural and independent voters
right.
that they lost. They want it to be their party and nobody else's party. The battle that they're engaged in is one of those sort of ideological purity type battles where you've got a core group of people that demand that all of their candidates think and believe a certain way, and they are more than happy to exile and push out anybody who strays off the reservation on even just one or two issues. I mean, they don't have room, and the Republicans have dealt with this in the past too, and they still do to some extent. You know, both parties sort of have this core, but you know, it's that old sort of political battle of, are you willing to accept somebody who maybe you only agree with 70-80% of? Right? Are you willing to accept those representatives, those elected officials who you don't agree with? They aren't in complete lockstep ideologically with you. And right now on the DFL side and the Democrat side, that Bernie Sanders wing, they are not willing to accept those right. Democrats.
Well, and causing confusion and, you know, when you speak to the uncharted territory we're in, you could have made an argument, right? Let's live in fantasy land for just a moment. We'll go to fantasy land for just a moment. If Dayton hadn't done the veto, all the, you know, and all the vetoes, yeah, and the bipartisan deals and the you know, the compromises that were made had passed, and we didn't have this looming tax issue next year and all the other things. You could have made an argument that the strategy that so many of these DFLers that are believing they need to go far left and more progressive wouldn't work, being that how are people feeling at home? Are people feeling secure? Are they feeling financially secure? How are they feeling about the future? At home, generally speaking, on a nationwide level, we're feeling better than we have in a long, long time based off the economy, the available jobs, job security, right? Security of the country. However, because Dayton went and vetoed everything, there's so much up in the air that it does raise the question, at least in my mind, can those more left-leaning, more progressive of the DFL capitalize on the confusion that Dayton laid out? That's not to say that he did that intentionally, but there are so many variables involved that you just can't look at it and really begin to break it down because you don't know how it's going to have an impact on individuals and how, like that looming tax issue next year,
yeah,
how is that going to be laid out on both sides to capitalize on, yeah, that? Who's going to have the better argument to fight for the fact that people are losing money next year?
Well, right now, the argument is very simply in favor of the Republicans, because the Republicans can go out on the campaign trail. They can go out door knock and say, look, we passed the bill. We passed tax conformity. We put it on the governor's desk. You would not be paying these excess taxes next cycle if the governor had just simply signed the bill that we passed. I don't know how, if you're a DFLer, you're going to campaign on put more of us in office.
Right. Right. You
know, because it's not like they typically run on lowering your taxes in the first place.
Right. Not to mention the fact that how are they going to be answering the question when presented of how do you feel about what Dayton did? Do you agree with what he did?
Right.
Getting back to this piece, they lay out sort of in historical terms, the party opposing the president usually does well in midterm elections, right? Minnesota will be at the epicenter of it all. This is according to DFL party chairman Ken Martin, with an open governor's race, three other constitutional offices, two U.S. Senate seats, and up to five competitive congressional seats, and the entire state house on the ballot. He went on to say this, there are lots of things we can't control, including who ends up filing, who doesn't file, who's in the race, who isn't in the race, who gets endorsed, who doesn't get endorsed. I couldn't help but read that statement and think, it kind of reads like you wish you could have. That kind of reads like you kind of wish that you had some control over that.
Yeah.
Some have blamed the insider nature of the DFL endorsement process for the primary races that have followed. They argued that the roughly 1,400 activists gathered on the late spring weekend to cast an endorsement vote have an outsized say in the election that results in candidates who are too far to the left to succeed across the state. And that's a very, I mean, to me, that's an incredibly relevant statement.
And you can say similar things about the Republican process as well. That's been a
sure.
that's been an across the board criticism of the endorsement process by a lot of people. In that, you know, to win the endorsement, to appeal to the people who devote so much time and energy and sacrifice to being a part of this process, being a delegate, going to the conventions, you do have to tack a little farther to the left or right, respectively, to get those endorsements and to win those people over, whereas running in a statewide election, a primary, you have to be a little bit more to the middle. So that is a very relevant criticism of the process.
And, you know, we spoke earlier today. Today's the last day where you can withdraw. So it will be interesting to see if anybody does bring it up, because one aspect of it we've only mentioned in passing a few times was so many top-tier DFL candidates competing against each other will put a strain on financial and organizational resources, with each candidate needing funds from donors to succeed in the primary even before a winner moves on to November. The state party can only spend money for endorsed candidates until after the primary. Broughton worries that DFL candidates it will hurt most are those in races not facing primaries but are still top-tier targets in November. That includes the 1st Congressional District, which is open after U.S. Representative Tim Walz decided to seek the governor's office, and the 2nd and 3rd Congressional Districts in the suburbs. And Dan Feehan said this, "My fear is that this will actually hurt 2nd District candidate Angie Craig." And 1st District candidate Dan Feehan, this is still Broughton speaking. "These other races are really competitive and they need the resources in the fall." To me, that dovetails back to Ken Martin's sort of comment of, these are things we couldn't control before. They really wish that this hadn't gone down the way that it went
down. There is a finite pool of resources available to candidates. I mean, that's just the reality. That's just the bottom line. So what is going to be the Democrats' priority? What is going to be the DFL's priority in this upcoming cycle? Is it going to be the governor's office? Is it going to be the attorney general's office?
Right.
Sure feels like
right. The
attorney general's office is going to be top three. Or is it going to be those districts where they feel like they have a chance?
This speaks to a much broader question, and it's probably not one that we're going to have an answer to until much later on, where, as you mentioned earlier, Drew, we kind of see who ends up really fully engaging in this primary process and who doesn't. I do wonder how much of this was talked about before everything went down, and how much of this was just individuals who rushed to get in. Like, how many people stayed up late in the hours after the DFL convention trying to put a game plan together, you know, leading into Tuesday? How much strategizing was really going on before all that went down? Or was this just all a free-for-all?
Chaos. Yeah. Yeah. I feel like in some respects, specifically in the attorney general respect, it was a lot of chaos. I mean, otherwise, the Mike Hatch situation wouldn't have played out the way it did.
True.
Where Mike Hatch is like, I gotta sign up because I don't know what this is gonna look like, and we cannot let this office fall into Republican hands. And then after he signed up, you know, everybody else signed up, and now he's out.
In the beginning part of the show, I mentioned these two paragraphs. They're really short. Usually this is the type of language discussed about exclusively with conservatives and Republicans. But listen to this. "For Dan McGrath, executive director of Take Action Minnesota Progressive Campaign Group, the divisions in the DFL," this cracks me up, "are now part of a bigger change happening in the DNA of the party. He thinks candidates like Swanson, a moderate who has been attorney general for more than a decade, represent a fading wing of the DFL party." Going on to say, "This is the old guard making an end run around the future of the party," according to McGrath, whose organization endorsed Murphy for governor. "For the DFL party 20 or 30 years ago, the political landscape in our state was very different. The candidates that are rising to the top right now are the ones who really understand how our state has changed demographically, racially, and they're carving out a vision for what that will look like." Says the individual who endorsed Murphy for governor. Okay.
I like that chasm.
Plenty of
I like the sound of the I like the echo.
Yeah.
That is bouncing around that canyon.
I really do. And again, that's usually talk that you only hear about Republicans, that division. It's usually always the left, the DFL, and Democrats, or they're always united. And again, that's typically been the case.
Yeah.
They say plenty of Democrats think the glut of candidates filing for office is simply a direct result of the enthusiasm across the party, voters and candidates alike. No man, it was a free-for-all.
No, that is not... No, enthusiasm would have meant these candidates would have been engaged before the convention, leading up to the convention, would have taken part in the convention and showed up and made their case to those delegates as to why they are the best choice for that particular office. This was a direct reaction to all of the chaos that came out of the convention. The point has been made by a number of people that Lori Swanson dropping out of the AG endorsement process and declaring that she's back in the governor's race, that was the trigger.
Right.
That set everything else in motion. You can't chalk that up to enthusiasm.
No.
You chalk that up to a massive vacuum that was created by Lori Swanson specifically, whether or not that was her plan all along. You know, some people believe it is. I tend to think it probably was. But regardless, that's irrelevant. But that's the vacuum that was created by that decision alone is what sparked all this. You can't chalk that up to enthusiasm.
No. No, McGrath. The last comment in here from McGrath from this particular group, this Take Action Minnesota, he says this: I'd much rather go into this general election with an incredible amount of energy more than anything else. The byproduct of that is it's going to be messy. What you have here from this individual is sort of a spin with the strength of a fidget spinner.
Right. Yeah, this person is trying to put out a house fire.
Zing!
With an 8-ounce glass of water and going, no, it's all fine.
This is fine.
What you have here is a lot of enthusiasm for putting out this fire. That's what you have
here. It's the thought that counts.
Aaron calling from Savage. Good morning, Aaron. Go ahead.
Good morning, guys. Love the show as always.
Thanks.
So I have a political comment, and then I have one thing quick for John and one thing for Sam, if that's okay.
Of course.
I'll just be over here.
It's only meant to help. Anyway, what you guys were talking about a little bit ago with Republicans kind of doing a couple of things that were self-destructive, like, you know, eating their own so quickly and also kind of letting the perfect be the enemy of the good, you know, it's kind of nice to see Democrats and what you call like the Bernie Sanders wing of it trying to take over. And if they want to eat their own for a while, I love to watch it, you know. I mean, it's great. Let them do it. So, John, I'm afraid you need to come back out of crazy town, okay, for, you know, this whole seats thing. It's not that big a deal. So, and Sam, I don't want to ask you your current dating status, but let's hope any future significant other wasn't listening to your comment this morning about sweating. Just saying.
Some would say that I'm worth the sweat, okay?
Wow. Thanks, Aaron. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Aaron.
Sam, did you pick up on you speak better John Jab than anybody else? Did you get what Aaron was saying at all?
I didn't.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Okay. You know what? I'm okay with that.
Apparently, you're in crazy town about your sheets. I don't know.
Oh, I'm in crazy town most of the time anyways, you know? But again, the psychosomatic part of me just justifies it, so we're good. It's fine.
It's the theme of this morning.
651-989-5855. All right, coming up, we will continue with a bit with this, especially from MinnPost, because this is, we got into this a lot yesterday, but this part and this rationale of why Keith Ellison is leaving a safe seat in Congress to make a risky bid for the Minnesota Attorney General, we've talked about it a couple of different times. We'll get into some of the details, this idea of how important these Attorney General seats are, not just here, but around the country, and how this is more of a tactical move being made by the left to be able to carry more influence. That's more influential in those seats than it would be for the individuals to stay in Congress. It's a real fascinating dynamic.
Also, James T. Harris, the beautiful man from Arizona, he'll be joining us in just about 35 minutes right here on Twin Cities News Talk. Justice.